Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is Assistant Editor Lee Boyce. And from back at base is Motoring Editor Rob Hull. And coming up, it's the Cash Edition. Are reports of its death greatly exaggerated? If not, are we as a society and our financial institutions ready to go cashless? But if you do have a spare bob or two, 48.5 million for a Ferrari, anyone? Well, bad luck, that's just sold. But don't worry, what about a larder for the bargain price of 75 grand? All this and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
TSB, RBS, HSBC, NatWest, Barclays, Visa Europe, and this week, Revolut. But I could go on. Challenger, FinTech, Established Bank. They all have one thing in common. None are immune to IT problems, from glitches to hacks to complete screw-ups and total meltdowns. After the TSB fiasco, which is still not fully resolved, regulators gave British financial firms until autumn to prove they could handle a cyber attack or an IT breakdown. Yet the momentum towards a cashless society shows no signs of slowing down. Contactless, digital currencies, bank branch closures. But are we ready to go cashless? Lee, a very warm welcome. Just the easy, quick question. Are we ready to go cashless? This is something you wrote about this week. So why were you writing about it, Lee?
That's correct. Well, there's been a number of reasons, actually, Georgie, why I've written about this. And it's been a bubbling away, I guess, in the fact that we're getting all pushed towards using contactless payments. We are being told how easy it is. We're having them pushed onto us. All current accounts pretty much come with them now without an option not to. There's been other little tidbits in the news as well. So the Bank of England, we're talking about scrapping 1 and 2p coins. The Royal Mint saying that the number of coins it's putting into circulation has halved in 4 years. There's all these little bits of information that are coming out that are showing us that perhaps we are just stopping from using cash.
And there's a difference, though, from cashless to a little bit less cash.
Yeah, but there's a little bit less cash than we were using 60% of all transactions with cash 10 years ago, and that's now dropped to a third, and it's falling, and it's falling, and it's falling. Contactless payments now make up a third of all transactions within a couple of years, and that's a pretty fast move towards us not really carrying cash anymore. And there's a number of reasons why that worries me and why I think that it's not a good move for Britain to go completely cashless. Now, I'll give you an example of a country that has gone pretty much cashless, and that's Sweden. It's phenomenally low out there now, Georgie, cash-wise. A lot of places don't even accept cash. I mean,
you're noticing that more, though, here, aren't you?
A little bit, yes.
I certainly am.
Let's think back to now things like getting on the bus in London. I mean, you know, you can't pay by change. You haven't been able to pay by cash for a little while. And in that kind of circumstance, it does kind of make sense in a way, because a lot of older people have bus passes, etc. Anyway, the whole argument is that it holds up buses when they have to dish out change, and it means that they don't run on time. So things like that, it kind of makes sense. But for everything to be going cashless, I think is a bit of a worry. I'll come on to the reasons why shortly.
Well, I've just named 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 reasons why. I'm talking about IT glitches, the total meltdowns, the absolute disasters that happened to all of the names that I mentioned earlier, and there are many more.
Well, this is it. So I was walking through M&S a couple of weeks ago. I wasn't actually looking to buy anything. A lady came up to me, a member of staff. She said, "Just to let you know, sir, none of our branches are accepting a card today. The whole system had gone." There was a story about it on the Daily Mail website, of course. So if I wanted to pay by card in there, I couldn't that day. We had Visa earlier in the year, so I was actually away in Copenhagen with some friends. A couple of my friends were really sort of like proud of the fact that they'd gone away without any of the local currency, any krona at all. And then the Visa thing happened on an evening, I think, if I remember rightly, on a Friday. And they had to beg, borrow and steal off us to cover the shortfall, because they couldn't use their Visa cards, which really did highlight that these glitches
can happen. We laugh, but that could leave some people in some really seriously difficult situations if they can't beg, borrow or steal.
Exactly. And you think about it. I mean, Visa has such a huge reach over what we do. I mean, they've been really behind some of the movements towards going to purely contactless. And there's other examples as well. You touched on TSB there. I mean, people were locked out of their accounts for a long time, and if they didn't have an alternative account, they would have been really sort of struggling. So what my argument is Technology isn't, it's definitely not foolproof. Will it ever be foolproof? Will we ever see a time where there won't be glitches? Well, I'm not convinced. And, you know, it's going to take heavy, heavy investment. And for that reason, I always carry cash around with me. I don't say I take bundles and bundles of cash, but I always like to have a little bit. Yeah.
So those strange people waiting outside.
See me with my thick wallet of cash. But I like to have a little bit with me. And actually, what I pointed out in this article is I like it for sort of smaller amounts of cash. So, for example, in a week, if I'm buying lunch or if I'm going to the pub, I prefer to use cash because actually data now for big banks, for governments, is a commodity, especially in the dawn of open banking. I don't particularly like my spending habits being seen. So you could see when I've been into this store, this shop, where I was in the country, it kind of frightens me a little bit. And I don't think a lot of people my age or our generation really think about that. And I know it sounds paranoid, but, you know,
those curly whirlies and little snacks. But actually, some stage, I mean, I joke there, but what about health insurers looking at stuff like
exactly.
how many McDonald's you're having of a week?
And who knows how that might be, at the moment, that data might not be used for that sort of thing, but that you've touched exactly on that. You know, you can actually start to build up a profile of your habits and what you're doing.
I'm as paranoid as you are, Lee.
and it's also, if you think about it, we always talk about when you're getting a mortgage and having everything together before you apply, so you're going to be accepted, right? So you think about all of the process you do to get your credit rating sorted and everything. What I tell my friends is at least 6 months before they're planning on applying for a mortgage is just to make their discretionary spending is as sort of, you know, vanilla as possible. So a bank manager can't go around and go, why are you spending £12 in Whole Foods? You know, you could have gone to Tesco, or, you know, it's that sort of thing.
Does that really happen?
Well, you can have a look.
We've
had stories like this in the past in which, you know, things like gym memberships, you know, you should be getting rid of your gym membership, this and this, so you can afford a mortgage. Well, there's a lot of little bits and pieces that we do on contactless that we would never have had a data footprint before on. You know, that couple of quid sandwich you get, a Boots meal deal, $3.99. Why are you not taking your own sandwich?
And actually, you've touched on the idea there that cash has always been used traditionally as a good way to learn how to save. The tips that a lot of people say is go and take cash and then you're less likely to spend on your contactless. And actually, there's probably something in that. And the added bonus of the fact that your bank manager can't see what you're spending your money on.
Exactly. So that's another point that I put in this column, actually, is the fact that it is way more, in my opinion, it's way easier to budget when you have cash. When you've got contactless, it's very easy just to sort of forget what you're doing, especially in a pub. I mean, if you're just in the pub late at night and you're buying rounds and then, you know, things get a little bit squiffy and you're just willy-nilly, just shove that on the contactless and you don't really think about it. Whereas if you have cash, you ought to have run out of cash. So actually, you know what? I probably should call it a night.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why banks and big financial firms are all pushing us towards contactless. It's not out of the goodwill of their heart. It's not because they think it makes things easier. There's got to be a reason behind it. And actually, again, in the column I've written about, I've actually picked a little bit on Halifax, and it's got an advertising campaign at the moment. It's everywhere, plastered on billboards, on my train station, wherever I drive, wherever I see it. And it says contactless, it's cash bustingly easy. And it's a TV advert in which the branch manager is telling the Ghostbusters character how easy it is.
Which seems a little bit behind the curve, doesn't it? Because I don't know many people who don't have contactless.
Well, exactly, no. But the advert, the whole tone of the advert, it makes me feel like at the end he sort of like shoots a ghost, you know, like they do in the film. And is that meant to be a metaphor for cash? Are they they want a cash bust? Why do we want to get rid of cash? It's almost like, buy cash. We don't need cash. Cash is rubbish. We're going to bust it.
Yeah.
And that kind of language, that's quite heavy for a bank, I think. It might all be in jest because it's, you know, pinned around Ghostbusters and whatnot. But there are reasons in which they want us to spend more on a card to see our whole footprint. And as I say, it sounds like the ramblings of someone that is paranoid, but I think it is a worry at how this data might be used in the future.
I don't think it's just the data, but I think any customer of TSB is probably on your side on this one. Anyone who's experienced what it's like to have the worry of perhaps being hacked into or having your computer system fail or the bank's computer system fail so you can't get money out, all of these sorts of things. I mean, the worst one for me is the most simple. Say you lose your card or whatever happens to it, it gets hacked and you have to cancel it.
Yep.
It then takes you sort of 5-7 days to go to a bank. And of course, all the bank branches are closed.
Yeah, this is it.
And it's like, if the whole thing isn't integrated properly, if you don't have a system in place in which you lose your card and you can immediately get another one, What is the point?
This is it. Yeah, exactly that, Georgie.
You're not ready. I keep just thinking, I just don't think the technology's ready or resilient enough.
I don't think it's caught up to the sheer amount of spend that we are now doing on this sort of technology. And let's not forget, also, you know, there are parts of the country that have just got absolutely rotten signal. And if you start pushing everyone onto contactless and people don't carry cash, I'm thinking about places like Cornwall, Devon. I'm thinking about the Lake District, you know, places that probably don't have the sort of signal to be able to cope with these kind of cashless payments. And then people turn up and go, well, what do you mean you know, only accept cash? You know, and it becomes that kind of, it gets into your mind a bit. So I know I touched on Sweden earlier. One critic says, this is someone that's been very outspoken about Sweden and the push towards contactless. We are vulnerable if we have no cash at all. Cash costs banks money to move around, whereas they can charge fees on cards. It is logical that banks have made it harder to use, right? A lot of the bank branches out there now have gone cashless. You don't even dish out cash. I mean, that's quite a worry. There's another country that's gone quite cashless as well, which is Zimbabwe, which had all of the hyperinflation and now uses the dollar. But it has a mobile money app. It's called EcoCash, and it's the main way to process and handle money out there. But again, back to the point that technology can go wrong. There was a glitch that hit that app in June, and it was so vast that the country's economy was hit. Because people couldn't make payments and they didn't have cash. I mean, things like that.
Terminator and Skynet. I know what happens.
Well, this is where it's all leading to, Georgie.
That's exactly.
Maybe I've just watched too many of those sort of 80s films that have frightened me a little bit.
Lee, what happened with Revolut? It sounds very similar to when you went away with your mates in Copenhagen and the whole visa issue.
Well, this is it, though. So we always pick on the big banks and we say, you know, when there's a glitch.
Yeah,
systems and all that sort of stuff. So then when it happens to a fintech, I think they get all a fluster a little bit. So financial technology, so these are like a new wave of challenges that are trying to disrupt banking, which is a sort of phrase I absolutely hate. It's just kind of like, just be a challenger and grow steadily and then make a splash. But Revolut, actually, it has grown phenomenally in the last couple of years. It's got 2.5 million users. How many of those are active? I don't know, because they won't give us an actual precise number on how many they are.
And that's
active,
it's really useful for people who go abroad, because you get near...
It's a currency exchange, basically, and it offers a fee-free currency card for users to have overseas. And there's been a number of challenges that have kind of offered that on Monzo and Starling, but Monzo's kind of reined its back a bit. And I think it's all well and good to do all these fee-free, but I sometimes wonder if it's a bit of a teaser way of getting people in, and then it ends up blowing up in their face almost. I mean, I actually opened a Metro Bank account. You know, they've been going now for about 8 years, but I actually opened it originally because it was free to use worldwide. You think about that. That is crazy. That must have cost the bank a hell of a lot of money. Went to Australia, used my Metro Bank card pretty much everywhere. Now it's only fee-free in Europe, but it's still handy. So I'm going away to Europe at the weekend, and I'll probably withdraw cash. Instead of having to carry a load of cash around, I'll quite possibly use my Metro card as a kind of emergency backstop. But Revolut offers a free currency card. That's the most popular feature of Revolut. And the growth, as I say, has been absolutely remarkable. But what it appears to have happened is that it didn't do the right kind of profiling of customers before they signed up and started depositing money and using it. So they have a set of things called Know Your Customer, which is all sorts of documents and proof that they need to prove that you are who you are and that you're going to use the account in the way that, you know, you promised to use it when you sign up for the terms and conditions. What the Revolut boss actually turned around and sort of told the National Crime Agency and told the FCA as well is that it had seen proof of money laundering via its app, which you think, okay, well, it's held up its hands and it's kind of said, look, we know we've got a bit of a problem. It'd be a small minority of customers that have had a problem. But what's happened in the aftermath of that is that innocent customers are now getting asked for all sorts of documents and proof that if you were away on holiday... and you're using this card, and it might be that people might have trusted it enough to put all of their holiday spending money onto this card to then use abroad to pay for meals. We had a reader get in touch. He was in Spain for an anniversary meal with his wife. He couldn't pay the bill because all he had was his Revolut card, and he'd been locked out.
That old chestnut.
Yeah, of course you did, mate. Yeah. Left me wallet at home. But basically, he's been asked for all sorts of documents, tax returns, bank statements, all sorts of things, which you're not going to have access to when you're away relaxing on holiday.
The moral, though, of this story, and I think you've said this many times before, is don't just go away with one thing.
Exactly. No, and it's very true that. But at the same time, that this guy had used Revolut a number of times. Mm. I mean, he sounds like he's travels with business. So he's obviously a savvy person. He realises this is one of the cheapest ways to spend money abroad. So fundamentally, Revolut's a good company in the fact that that service it offers is great for consumers. But when things go wrong, it really highlights in this case, they've just got a small customer services team. Half of it's based in London.
Absolutely,
half
yeah.
of it's based in Poland. They don't have a telephone number. They don't have an email address. It's all done via chat, via its app, which that is quite a lot of pressure to put on a few staff that are just dealing with those chatbot things. Some of the complaints have run into days and days and days, and people have been promised calls back and all that sort of stuff. Actually, it's like what we've been saying. I take the example of like an energy firm.
Exactly. You know, the smaller energy firms,
you know, they've grown too big, and then they can't deal with all of when something goes wrong or there's something that needs sorting. If there's a deluge of customers that then need it at the same time, it puts the whole service under strain. And that's what's happened. And on its social media websites and everything, it does not make for pretty reading. I mean, people are absolutely yeah. incredulous about how they've been locked out of their accounts and how they've gone about handling the customer service side of it. It's got to be a wake-up call to a fintech firm like this. It's all well and good moving everything onto an online platform. Sometimes you just want to pick up the phone, speak to a human on the other end who can go, right, yeah, this makes no sense. We can sort this out now. Not talking to a chatbot.
This is what the traditional banks have in their favour, I suppose. While they may have the legacy IT systems, at least they've got the services in place. If something does go wrong, that they can actually, you have someone to speak to. And I think this is the problem. It's not just energy firms. It's not just things like Revolut mm-hmm. or any of these sort of app-based, you know, cleaning services or anything. Mm-hmm. They can do it relatively cheaply, but they do it by cutting costs elsewhere, which generally seems to be customer service.
Exactly. And exactly that. And actually, one thing that I've picked up on this Revolut thing that I think is a little bit... They're stepping on some dangerous territory, in my opinion, because on the website, the first thing that comes up, an advert, it says, this is your bank account or something. But it's not a bank account. This has nothing to do with banking, really. It doesn't have FSCS protection. Mm. So that will alarm people that have got money in it. If they can't, if you put like £1,000 into that and you, for whatever reason, have been locked out of it and you can't get into it and it's taken days and days and days, you fear the worst. You do, because it's not a company that's been going for decades. This is a company that's been going a couple of years. And it offers no sort of FSCS protection. And then you start to panic. They've just not gone the right way about dealing with staff. And I think this has got to be a lesson learned to a company like Revolut and all of its rivals and competitors to see this is not how you run a customer services side of a business. And actually, fintechs as well, they've had a really quite easy ride, I would say, in the last couple of years, especially in the press, in the fact that, you know, we've all been kind of like impressed by the way that they've been managed to cut fees and how they've not got these legacy systems and how they can kind of be a bit more nimble and, you know, offer some good competition to consumers. But they can't expect an easy ride forever. You know, things like this are going to go wrong, and we need honesty and transparency to have confirmation that they are learning lessons from this and making sure moving forward they'll not suffer from these sort of things again.
I had a problem myself, Lee, with an app-based house cleaning service. Oh. I'd love to be able to physically do it myself, but I can't. I don't really want to either.
Would you launder and cashier it?
No, but they kept cancelling about six times, and they said, oh, because we've got so many people coming on all the time, you know, it's hard to make sure it's all the processes. I said, look, if that is the case, you are expanding too quickly. If you cannot provide the service that you say that you have done, you're expanding too quickly, so you need to pull back. Anyway, that's another rant for another day, and trust me, that day will come. But Lee, before we move on, the one final question I want to ask you, and I sort of implied it at the start, is the momentum is building, we're going towards this cashless society, but I'm wondering, is it sort of slowing down? Do you think we're going to get to you know, an equilibrium where a little bit of cash in society is a good thing, or do you think we're going to fully go Sweden?
I can't see us fully going Sweden, but then Sweden probably 5 years ago didn't know it was going to go fully Sweden.
Yeah,
so I mean,
it's kind of
a hard one to judge. But I would say the growth of contactless, I mean, when you compare it to cash and it's now, you know, basically on par, you could never have predicted that 5 years ago. I don't think that kind of really fast push. My hunch is that it won't, because I think people like to have the flexibility to have a bit of everything. You know, I quite like all methods of payment. I think having all methods of payment is good. I like using my debit card or credit card for certain purchases because it offers protections. You've got some redress if things go wrong. With cash, you don't quite have that same thing. But I go back to the point I made right at the beginning. You know, you can't see my spending habits with cash. That's why, fundamentally, I think that a lot of people would be suspicious of going completely contactless. And I think those suspicions are correct. But, you know, it's up to you as a person. If you're comfortable with banks or government agencies or whatever seeing how you have your spending on your card, then that's fine. It's not a problem. But all I'm going to say is I would definitely hold some cash and do some spending with cash, because we will regret it if it goes.
This is Money. Brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
While we're in the mood for a bit of a grumble about financial services companies, step up Lloyds. Now, Lee, it's been a wee while since you've had a pop at them. So regular listeners to the show will know that Lee's been, this has just been slow burn for you. Every so often you'll come up and you'll have a little pop, and it always seems to be about sales targets. So before we do anything, you're going to have to take us right back, because this has got some context to it.
Yes, indeed. So it's not having a pop at Lloyds per se. I mean, it's just the fact that, you know, it's one of, if not the biggest bank in Britain, you know, customer wise, the amount of current account customers it has and the amount of reach it has and always has had on our high street is vast. Now, what this all stems back from is, I feel like I should get like into the past.
Sound effects, but we're not that posh.
I started looking into this in about 2011, 2012, and I had a number of branch members getting in touch with me, worried about the sales practices that were happening at Lloyds. And what that meant was spreadsheets with certain products having points on them and trying to reach a certain amount of points by the end of the month to get bonuses, and you were incentivized to open up certain products and things that might have not been suitable to certain customers, and that sort of thing was in play. And
which some people may say, look, that might sound familiar anywhere that needs to make sales, but let's give the context that this was so close after financial crisis, and you're talking about a bank here and actually customers that shouldn't be able to afford it. Hello, that sounds familiar.
Exactly that. So I had this Stop the Hard Sale campaign, actually, and it was fined £28 million in December 2013 by the FCA for not being able to control its sales incentive schemes. And part of that was the investigation that we, you know, had done. There was a lot of information, and We got our hands on all sorts of sheets and lists of points and things that hadn't been published elsewhere before. It was a real sort of one of those subjects for me where I felt for the staff. They were under pressure, and people were making financial decisions based on things that they probably shouldn't have been doing. Anyway, to cut a long story short, they stopped doing that kind of sales practices, and they've brought in this like customer needs met thing, which is basically some jargon to say, you know, are you ticking off a list of everything that you should be offering customers and whatnot? Now, what's happened since? So I've been contacted by a couple of staff members again, and they are saying that the atmosphere in the branch has completely turned into a bit of a sales frenzy again. And the way that this is doing, they're doing this without alerting, I guess, the FCA with the sort of sales figures and the points and the targets and everything, is they're now recording all product openings, right? So they've been doing it with mortgages since the middle of last year. But now if you go into any Lloyds branch, I think they're currently piloting it, but it's going to be rolled out, you know, entirely. If you wanted to open a current account, for example, you'll be taken into a room. They will tell you that you're being recorded, and you will open a current account with the advisor. Now, what they can do then, this has been recorded, their line manager can then listen to that recording, you know, within an hour to see if they've done everything, you know, that they should have done to make sure that they're offering the other products perhaps that they should be offering alongside.
So their argument would be, no, we're just making sure that our sales practices are in line with FCA regulation. What the staff or other cynical people may suggest, not suggesting staff are cynical, but is that actually this is
sounds through the back door, basically.
Right, exactly. And a big brother watching are you offering actually the products that we want you to push?
If you think about it, what staff are saying is that it's making them feel a little bit robotic, because they can't have that natural conversation with someone because they know they're being recorded, and it's almost just like reading off a sheet. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's not like, you know, oh, lovely weather today, you know, how have you been? I don't think there's much of that now because everyone's so nervous about wasting time doing that sort of thing. They've just got to get this done, and it's done, and it's like, who's through the door next kind of thing. I think it's a bit of a shame, really.
But they're shooting themselves in the foot because who's going to recommend that? I mean, when you go and you sort of take out a product at a bank or indeed anywhere, sorry, having a friendly hello, how are you doing, really goes a long way for me. I don't know about you, Lee.
Exactly. But the other thing I've kind of alluded to in this story, and what I think is another part of this, is that it is a helpful way for the bank to stop another PPI mis-selling scandal, for example. You know, if they had recordings of everyone that had opened current accounts in the past and said, oh, by the way, this is PPI, you know, would you like it on this because of this, this and this? They've got the proof that they'd spoken about PPI and why it might be suitable for that person.
Mm.
And how would someone then get compensation from that? Because there's a recording of them saying, yes, I understand.
But I wonder how long you'd be able to keep those.
Well, I think it's like 6 years usually for things like that. But saying that, I don't know if that's really feasible for voice recordings just because of
the
sheer amount
of
data.
As someone who knows what radio is, that would be...
We're getting into a real sort of like...
In-depth
chat about this. But... what they said to me, what staff said to me, is basically, if you don't want to be recorded in branch opening products, and you simply can't have the product, or you have to phone up and do it on a telephone, which is recorded anyway. Or online. So it's interesting. Lloyds came up with, I don't know where they got this stat from, but they said that 96% of its customers are happy to be recorded when opening a product in branch.
Does this happen anywhere else?
Let's
find out if it does.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I have a little box in that story for staff to get in touch. So if you do work in a bank branch or know anyone that does and they're seeing something similar, please do get in touch.
All right. Well, let's move on from that to James Bond's wheels, Lee. A bit of a U-turn, sorry. Aston Martin revealing plans to float on the London Stock Exchange. Lee, what's happening here? What does it actually mean for a company? Why is this significant?
Well, it just means that, you know, you can have investors buy a share into the business, basically. And something like Aston Martin is one of those brands in which it does have quite a passionate fan base.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
and it obviously
it's
has
legendary,
the, has the prestige... globally for attracting investors and people to be interested in getting involved. So it basically just lists on the London Stock Exchange along with, you know, other big companies that are already on there. Whether or not it'd be big enough to get onto the FTSE 100, which is the 100 biggest companies currently listed on the stock exchange, is to be seen. It's not a guarantee. It's valued at, they reckon it'd be about £5 billion, which... it's actually really quite a big amount of money when you consider the history of Aston Martin and its recent history, because through the millennium and sort of that kind of bit, the early 2000s, it was actually struggling quite a lot. It wasn't doing particularly well. It got taken over in 2007 by an American businessman and some Kuwaiti investors, and they've kind of turned around the fortunes a little bit. So it was actually owned by Ford. It was on the stock market before in 1990.
Which is interesting, all of this as well. In that we were talking about Uber earlier in the week and how investment in cars is different now, because I suppose what people are thinking is with going green, with electric, personal car ownership is on the decline, and actually it's going to be fleets of cars, and that's why Toyota's investment in Uber was such a significant move, they were suggesting. So it's interesting that for $5 billion we're still getting Aston... I can't imagine fleets of Uber Aston Martins, to be honest.
Well, out in Dubai you probably would, in the Middle East,
point.
And China. So the thing is, something like Aston Martin and the connection to James Bond is that although there's a limited market probably in Britain, there's a limited market also in the States, also a prestige brand out there, and people, it's popular. But you've had the rise of the money in the Middle East, in China, you know, in Dubai, in Russia. You know, all of these countries are probably Aston Martin buyers, and actually they've probably had a big sales drive, especially like China. You think about the amount of people now that are getting money and want those best brands, especially British, you know, a British brand like that is iconic because it's James Bond, you know. And also, it's not just cars, it has diversified into other areas. So for example, it has a luxury apartment block opening up in Miami, in which I think the starting price for some of those apartments are like $35 million. So they're trying to diversify the brand a little bit and use that brand. You know, do you want to live in an Aston Martin apartment? Well, some people probably would, and you'd probably get a free Aston Martin if you do it. But the actual profit of the company is not that vast. You know, they can only turn out a certain amount of cars per year. I think it's about between 2,500 and 3,000 cars a year that get rolled off the production line. They're very bespoke made, and that's why they carry, you know, a high price tag. I think the average price tag something over £150,000. That's a lot of money for a car.
But if you have a brand that's so iconic like that, you can stick it all over hats and t-shirts and all
exactly sorts of things. And it sells, and people love it. I've actually been to the Aston Martin factory in Gaydon in Warwickshire. I did a sort of tour a few years ago, and it's everything you wouldn't expect a factory workshop to be. It was really bright, airy, clean. Mm. It was like walking into like an Apple showroom. It was incredible. And everyone was super friendly. And I remember watching these women, they were hand-stitching, you know, the upholstery onto the seats and all that sort of thing. It is a luxury brand. And people will want to buy into it. Now, what I will say is that the ordinary bloke on the street is not going to be able to invest in this straight off, and it's going to be open to staff, and it's going to be open to people that bought Aston Martins in the past. They're going to get the first dibs on this, and I think some institutional investors will get first dibs on buying a chunk of Aston Martin. But when it does list, obviously people then can get involved. Whether it would be popular or not, I don't know.
We shall see.
You've got to do your maths on this. I mean, the profit, it's not vast for something that's going to be valued at £5 billion. But I guess the key is diversifying. And the other key is, can it keep up its sales growth in countries such as China? And if China suddenly saw an economic slump or whatnot, it would probably have a big knock-on effect, I would suggest, to Aston Martin.
There's a lot of ifs in there, but we shall see. Talking about things that aren't for everyone, probably because they're out of the price ranges. Hello to the most expensive car ever to be sold at auction. What makes a Ferrari, indeed any car, worth £48.5 million? Well, let's head on over to This Is Money HQ and speak to motoring editor Rob Hull. Welcome, Rob. Thank you very much for joining us from This Is Money HQ. Before we crack on, please tell everybody what you're eating right now, because I was a bit astonished earlier when I found out.
Oh, come on, it's chocolate chip banana bread.
Right.
It's vegan. Vegan.
Right.
Yeah. This is nothing to do with me. I'm told what to eat, and I eat it. So
You've gone all posh.
I have very little choice. No, I've not gone posh.
I don't know you anymore, Rob.
I'm preparing for married life, so I say yes a lot.
Touché. OK, well, someone said yes to this Ferrari for £48.5 million. Oh, my goodness. Do we know who bought it and why?
We don't. We don't know who's bought it, but it sounds like it's going to be a sound investment even for that amount of money, which sounds bonkers saying that. But they reckon that the prices of that model in particular is going to go up in the next 5 years, so and could almost double. It's some Ferrari historians believe by 2023 a car like that is worth over $100 million, which is a frightening prospect.
Why is it going up so quickly? What is it? Is it just Ferrari, or is this that whole industry?
Classic cars is, in recent reports, has been said a better investment than just about anything else on the planet. It's about being
smart. That's some claim, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But you can kind of see, it depends where in the market you're shopping. If you're going right at the top end, then yeah, that's definitely the case. With these Ferraris, 250 GTOs were extremely rare. They only made just over 30. They dominated racing in that era. Were driven by some of the most famous drivers of that era. It's a real legend, which is why the value's going up. And because no one wants to sell them, the opportunity of actually one coming on the market is so rare at the moment that this is driving the prices up. But that's very much at the top end. It's kind of, you've got to be very careful about what you're looking at. We ran a story a couple of months ago about someone in the UK who had kept hold of a Jaguar XJS for 28 years, barely driven it, done less than 1,000 miles, kind of gone through this process of right, let's keep it in pristine condition because it's going to be worth a load of money in the future, comes around to sell at an auction and it sells for less than what it would have originally been worth when taken into account inflation. So they've kept that car, not driven it. It's not gone up in value at all.
Why? So what was the reason with that one? Just as nobody wants it?
It's about what's really in the market, what's going up and what's going down. We've seen real fluctuations in the last 10 years. Stuff that's fairly modern. You're looking at 80s hot hatches are going through the roof at the moment, which is why our esteemed editor, Mr. Lambert,
exactly owns
a 205 GTI and frequently mentions it. But that, you know, that's a sound investment because they are going up in value. It really is about picking the right car at the right time, finding that sweet spot, and just monitoring the market and seeing what's in demand and what isn't.
I do have to ask, though, a Lada for 75 grand? Come on, Rob, you're having a laugh, right?
Even I didn't believe this. When I read it, I had to look at it again because, you know, Lada, it is, you know, the laughing stock of of the motor industry, you know, of consumers have made jokes about them in the past. I mean, I found my favourite three jokes about Lada. Yeah. What do you call a convertible Lada?
Oh, I do know this one. Lee, what's the answer?
Not telling.
Oh, okay. Forgotten.
A skip.
That's it.
What do you call a convertible Lada with two exhausts? A wheelbarrow. What do you call a Lada at the top of a hill?
A miracle.
A miracle. There you go. Lee gets the last one.
Well done, Lee. Fantastic. You've come prepared, Rob. So be that as it may, 75 grand for a skip, a wheelbarrow, or a miracle. I think it's a miracle, isn't it?
Yeah, and you look at the images of this car. It's not what you'd say in pristine condition. It's an ex race bred car, so it's competed in the Paris-Dakar Rally quite a few years ago, 1981. So it's you could consider it a classic, but it's pretty much in exactly the same condition. It didn't cross the finish line because it failed to finish. But that year was remembered because a Lada actually came third. A few of them entered that year. And Paris-Dakar Rally is notoriously the most difficult race to complete. It's over the course of almost a month. It's across desert terrain. It is extremely difficult. So for a Lada to finish third was incredible. And this is one of the entries that was in it. Didn't finish, but my only assumption is that there's not many of these around in terms of ones that competed in that race, so which is why it might have driven up the value a little bit.
Loving your driving puns as well. And your jokes, Rob. Thank you so much for joining us. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you very much to Rob. And if you do like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.